Welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast. Okay, first things first, I've got some relevant science news. You may remember a few episodes ago we heard from Dr. Jared Goldberg, who talked to us about his theory that Betelgeuse had some kind of beetle buddy. In other words, based on the star's observed periodic variability over human history, you could infer that there was another object orbiting Betelgeuse, causing it to get periodically brighter and dimmer over time. I actually wasn't convinced at the time, because of course you might imagine there could be many possible ways of causing a star to have periodic variability. However, this past month, Dr. Goldberg's theory might have just been confirmed by observations from the Gemini North Telescope in Hawaii, where they see a bright spot indicating a possible companion star exactly where Dr. Goldberg predicted it should be. My wife, Dr. Abigail Pullen, emailed him a congratulations, but apparently he's still not 100% convinced himself. I guess it seems too good to be true, but we'll have a better idea in a few years if we take another photo and that bright spot has moved, showing that it's properly orbiting around Betelgeuse. To me, it's just shocking that Betelgeuse is one of the brightest stars in our sky, and humans have been looking at it for longer than recorded history, and yet we might have been looking at a binary star system all along without realizing it. Okay, enough about Beetle Buddy. This episode, we're back to talking about black holes. There are a few things in astrophysics so incredible. Around a black hole, space and time have become so distorted that light is unable to escape. Yet astronomers have now found many ways of detecting black holes, either because of the light from the accreting gas surrounding it, or more directly by measuring the distortions they make in the fabric of space-time when they orbit around each other. And of course, you may be aware of the efforts by the Event Horizon Telescope to directly image the gas around black holes, from which we have two incredible images, one of the black hole at the center of the galaxy M87, and another from the black hole at the center of our own galaxy, which we call Sagittarius A star, or Sag A star for short. These two black holes are what astronomers call supermassive black holes. Supermassive black holes are more massive than a million suns, some as large as 10 billion times the sun's mass. Each supermassive black hole lives at the center of a galaxy, and we sometimes refer to them as the nucleus of that galaxy. Some of these galactic nuclei just lie dormant at the center of the galaxy, much as Sag A star does in our galaxy, but others are actively eating gas, which emits some of the brightest radiation you can see visible from across the observable universe. So, what happens to these nuclei when two galaxies merge? Two galaxies mean two supermassive black holes at their nucleus, and these two galactic nuclei eventually must form into a binary system after the galaxies merge. This is a colossal idea, the merger of two galaxies, followed by the merger of two black holes at their cores, each one possibly billions of times the mass of the sun. That's the sort of thing my guest today specializes in. We'll be talking with Dr. Daniel D'Orazio from Space Telescope Science Institute about supermassive black hole binaries and how we can detect them and what we can learn from them. I'm Paul Duffel, and this is the Astrophysics Podcast. We almost did a whole podcast without recording anything. All right. Welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast. I'm Paul Duffel, and my guest today is Dr. Daniel D'Orazio, who is an astronomer at Space Telescope Science Institute. Dr. D'Orazio, thank you for joining me on my little podcast.
Hi, Paul. It's great to be here. Thanks.
So, most of my guests are, I just invite people I know to come on, and you are no exception. We've known each other for over a decade. We first would have met in, like, I don't know, 20...
Probably around 2013?
2013 or something like that.
Just after that, yeah.
And, yeah, so we would have been... We were both in New York City. I was at NYU. You were at Columbia. And then our advisors collaborated a lot,
I remember doing simulations with Zoltan and Andrew, our advisors, and then soon after I wrote my first paper there, I met Paul Duffel, who went down to NYU, who was writing his own different hydro code, mm-hmm. And then I think you gave me a tutorial on how disco worked one day, the chalkboard at NYU, and then we've been working on that stuff ever since.
Ever since.
Yeah.
So we're going to start the podcast by talking about you and how you got into science. So let me start by asking, where did you grow up?
Yeah, I grew up in central eastern Pennsylvania in a small town called Orangeville, Pennsylvania. So...
Right. So it's funny because also my wife, Abigail Pullen, the first guest of the podcast, was also from, not from that town, but from the town in Pennsylvania, sort of ruralish Pennsylvania.
Yeah. She's from like Lancaster area.
Right?
There's also the Pennsylvania Dutch, the mm-hmm. Amish connection up where I live, where
right.
I grew up.
Right, right. Yeah. So there's, so this one, so you're out in Amish country. Were you on a farm too?
No, but we had a, yeah. Farms around us and forests around us, but yeah. Didn't grow up on a farm, no.
Right, right. Yeah. Okay. And so, yeah, what was it like? I mean, what's it like growing up out there?
I spent a lot of time outside. I used to make teepees, you know. You'd get some dead branches or even, like, yeah, pretty much dead branches. And that was my favorite pastime, go outside and make big teepees.
Just pictures. Yeah. Would you have a sheet or something?
No, I would just try and cover it in brush. That was advanced. If I had extra time, I would cover it with whatever was around. I used to make bow and arrows, too. So I spent a lot of time with sticks.
Oh my God. Did you grow up in the 1940s in a sandlot? But, so, yeah, okay. I didn't know that. But, if you thinking back to when you were a kid, do you have a memory of the first time you started getting interested in science or astronomy?
I can't pinpoint it to anything specific, but... Mm-hmm. I think just a combination of actually long car rides with my dad to go to wrestling tournaments.
To wrestling tournaments?
Yeah, so I was a wrestler in Pennsylvania. That's a thing.
Where is this going?
Yeah, no, actually, that's funny. Yeah. So we'd wake up really early and drive to these wrestling tournaments at 6 a.m. And I think I just remember listening to NPR with my dad.
Okay.
And talking about, well, lots of things, but science, I think, was one that happened a lot. For some reason, that sticks in my mind.
So you'd be on the road listening to that. You're getting geared up to go to a wrestling tournament.
Yeah, which I never really wanted to do most of the time. So it was more fun to.
So while you're on the journey there, you got to have this. NPR is, you know, people softly speaking on the radio about something in the news or in science or something, and then that was.
Yeah, my dad, yeah, I like to think about that stuff, and we talk about, you know, deep thoughts in the car, so oh. I feel like that was part of it.
Okay.
I'm sure there are other things, but that's, yeah, that comes to mind right now.
So you were talking about your dad, so what did your parents do?
Yeah, so my dad, when I was growing up, worked at a sawmill. He, did lumber stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom worked for the state of Pennsylvania for the welfare office, so.
Okay.
Yeah, and then my dad ended up selling books later, actually. He was laid off from the sawmill and got a job selling books to schools.
So. Selling books to schools?
Yeah.
Oh.
So I'd spent a lot of time, actually, in the garage helping him put books in bins. Actually, the whole family did.
So he was, like, selling, like, he was, like, a sales guy? Like,
yeah, trying to sales rep for this big company.
Oh, for, like, textbooks?
Actually, it was just...
Just books that were
like
in their library?
It was, like, before Amazon, before everyone bought things on Amazon.
Okay.
He'd put books in the teacher's lounge, and then they would buy stuff on their time off or their break. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. So, okay. And I'm sure, so that job probably doesn't exist anymore either.
No, he retired in 2019. And okay. I think the company no longer.
Well, okay. So would you say your parents is like, were influences on you and, you know, got you interested in science?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe not on purpose.
Okay.
Or maybe it was on purpose. Maybe. I'm not sure. But yeah, I think they just had a really... granted my sister and I a lot of freedom in what mm-hmm. we thought about and wanted to do and in many ways. So
okay.
Yeah.
So it wasn't necessarily like so they themselves weren't academics, but they would entertain enjoyable conversations about the universe or things like that or whatever science things in the car or
yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, so then would you say there was any influence that sort of led you to feeling like that was a career path?
Yeah, actually, that took a while. So I remember actually in high school, probably in ninth grade. Yeah, I remember they had, I think I got to the point where I thought what I wanted to do was engineering and then aerospace engineering because that had something to do with space.
Right. Okay. Okay.
I remember that Air Force people came to school and you could talk to them if you wanted to do something in aerospace engineering.
Okay.
So I talked to them like, oh, you know, yeah, that's if you like space and math, that's what you should do. So I think I went along with that for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And then in, yeah, probably sophomore or junior high school, I took a chemistry class.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was one of those kids that wasn't really doing the homework. But my teacher was really good, and I think he recognized that maybe you should just give this kid something else to do.
Uh-huh.
So he gave me this book, Brian Greene, The Elegant Universe.
Oh.
Yeah, so maybe you see where I'm going. And I think I read that, and I was like, I don't think it was the string theory that struck me. I think it was fun, cool to read about, but I think what struck me was like, people do this for a living.
Oh, yes. Right? The idea that, that like you can think about an ant on a garden hose and then that's like your job.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's not, that is kind of incredible to think about that, like, yeah, that there are people that this is the type of thing you can do. Like, think about what is the universe made out of and how does that work?
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, so
that's funny. I also read The Elegant Universe and was like excited by it when I was I was probably in college at the time, but yeah, it was a similar type of thing. Like, I mean, I don't think I had the same realization of like, oh, people just do this for a living. I don't know. I still am kind of coming to terms with that concept.
Yeah.
but it's, yeah, that I remember reading that book too and having an influence on me. And I remember it also when I went to NYU, a lot of the people there had read The Elegant Universe and they were like, yeah, he tricked a whole generation of scientists into doing string theory. But because it was really well written and convinced people it was a really interesting thing to work on. But anyway, that was just a joke that people said. So then how did it go towards like physics and astrophysics? Like you said, at the Air Force was like, you should do engineering or aerospace engineering, but then how did it move? Like, so there was Brian Greene's book, I guess, that got you an idea that this kind of thing was a job.
Yeah. And then I took a physics, the high school physics course and realized that's the thing. And I really liked that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think, my physics teacher in high school in that physics course, I think, really solidified that that's what I wanted to do. And then when I went to college, I think, excuse me. Yeah, then I went to college. I had, remember my freshman year, 8 a.m. calculus class.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
everybody had one of those.
Yeah. And I feel like in high school, I never was like a great student. Nobody was ever telling me like, yeah, you're smart, you're a straight A student.
Okay.
When I went to college, I feel like I had this new idea that, like, you know, I want to do physics, string theory, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was really into this calculus class, and I think I just did really well and I had good teachers that said, hey, you can actually do this. And I think that turned it around and I focused on doing physics and astronomy. And
I feel like I had a similar kind of experience between high school and college, where high school I felt like it wasn't really my speed, the way the classes were taught. But then in college, it was a very different approach of like, you're taking this class because you want to learn about this subject, not because it's mandated by state law.
Yeah.
It's like, you're taking this, would you be interested in learning about, you know, physics or calculus or like, you know, and, you know, of course there are requirements still, but it is a different, I guess, attitude that it, at least in principle, it's a different attitude in the classroom.
Yeah. And there's a different clarity, I suppose, that I'm learning this because of things I can do with it, and that's exciting.
Oh yes, yeah. You're motivated by what here. I want to understand this because it's going to help me understand the universe.
Yeah.
And so that was that got you interested in. So that was moving you in the direction of physics, and then where did you go to college?
Juniata College, which is out near State College, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
It's in, yeah, central Pennsylvania.
Okay. And so did you, like, you know, you were going to make, what did you major in?
Physics and math.
Physics and math.
Yeah, and that's what I just wanted to do from the beginning of college.
Okay, okay. And so then, when did you make the transition towards astrophysics?
Yeah, for some reason, I always wanted to do, like, I always really liked astrophysics.
Right.
And I took one astrophysics class at Juniata, because luckily there was a professor that offered that 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure why I wanted to do that. I think just because of big questions, general relativity, Einstein, who knows, mm-hmm. but it was all exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but I only really, so while I was at Juniata, I did optics stuff. Quantum optics is an optics lab.
Okay.
Laser locking things, because that's what was there. And so I did an REU at Stony Brook in laser type stuff.
Okay.
But then I really wanted to get in astronomy, so I applied for an REU and luckily got one at the CFA in Cambridge, Center for Astrophysics.
Oh, okay.
In Cambridge. And then there I did my first astrophysics project on gravitational lensing, and then that's really...
So tell me about that. You were doing an REU, meaning a research... what is that?
Something? Yeah, the research experience for undergraduates funded by the NSF at various universities.
Right. And then the Harvard Center for Astrophysics accepted you as an REU student. And so you went to Cambridge and did this project. What was the project, and who was it with?
Right. Yeah. So it was with a postdoc at the time named Greg Dobler.
Okay.
And he worked with Doug Finkbeiner
okay.
at Harvard. And Greg had worked a lot on gravitational lensing, and the project was essentially you have these distant quasars. Bright accreting black holes in the mm-hmm. universe, and sometimes there's a big galaxy between us and those quasars, and it gravitationally lenses that quasar.
So you have a bright source, like this quasar is this bright thing, which is an accreting black hole, and then between it and us, there's a big galaxy, and because of gravity, it distorts the path of light, and so it actually lenses the light. It bends it around the galaxy. So
exactly, and in this case, so extremely that you see multiple images of that quasar. Even though there's really one, you see multiple images
right.
of it.
As sort of an optical illusion.
Yeah.
From the fact that light gets bent around the galaxy.
Exactly. And so not only did you see multiple images, this project was about the fact that you can predict how bright they should be all compared to each other. Because you can predict that from general relativity.
Okay, so you can do a calculation of how the light gets bent and how it gets focused. And mm-hmm. so some of them will get focused in a different way and they'll be brighter than others. And so you can compute. There should be some relationship between how bright they are and where they're positioned.
Yeah, exactly. And so we were computing aspects of how if there's some clumps of dark matter in that galaxy between us and the source, how it might change those ratios. So
okay.
it was a really great first theoretical.
Yeah, there's a lot of fun, cool physics in there.
Yeah.
That's cool. So that kind of got you onto the path because that was your first REU, first astrophysics research project.
Yeah, and that, I think, started everything that followed.
Right, right. That's cool. So then, and then you got into grad school at Columbia. Because I know that part of the story.
Well, actually, before that, that connection I made with people at the Center for Astrophysics mm-hmm. Gave me a connection in Switzerland, where I got a Fulbright Fellowship. And so after I finished college, I actually went to the University of Zurich to do research there.
Oh, you were in Zurich for like a year? That's cool. Didn't know that. At what point do you feel like you learned how to be a scientist?
Wow, that's a great question, Paul. It's a continual process.
Okay.
Yeah.
Whenever somebody tells me that's a great question, I'm like, stop telling me it's a great question. Just answer.
Just answer.
But no.
Well, maybe what I mean is that maybe I should have asked myself that.
Oh, okay. In other words, you've gotten to this point and you never really asked whether you're a scientist or not, or what does that even mean? Well, what do you think it means?
I think... Yeah, let me think about that. What does it mean to
be a
scientist?
Do you want me to edit out all the time when you're not saying
anything? No, it's okay. Only if it goes on way too long. Yeah, I think it's looking at things in a way where you can distill what is it that I can predict and follow up and learn something. Asking questions in a really honed way for me.
In a really, I thought you were going to say in a scientific way.
Yeah, well, I was going to say a dry way, but that's not really what it is. Okay. Like a distilled way.
Okay.
And then being able to follow a path of questioning.
Okay.
To learn something. And so honing that process has taken a long time, but...
Right. So you're saying that's a continual process, learning how to do that, learning how to... how to do the scientific method, how to come up with, how to ask questions in a really particular way that you will get an answer that is like meaningful.
Yeah. And understanding too, that you're asking questions in a particular way. So you're obviously not asking some questions that might also still be interesting, but then you start getting into science and philosophy, the line between that.
Of course. So. Of course. I love that line. So then you're saying that's a continual process. You think like, would you say that you developed that process while you were in grad school? Like you learned how to...
Yeah. I think the process of grad school, that's where that happened for sure. And then going off and being a postdoc after that is solidifying some of those things that you developed as a grad student. Yeah, I think that was how it worked for me.
Okay. So now you're an astrophysicist. What do you like the most about your job?
Yeah, practically day to day, I think I find joy in two aspects.
Mm-hmm.
Joy, yeah. Well,
that's
what
fine.
I like.
You
yeah.
can say joy. We can say joy on this podcast. It's not explicit content. What do you find joy in your job?
Yeah. So recently, it's going to the office and talking with my colleagues or students about what we're working on, like just talking about the science and then thinking about what to do next, looking at what we're finding, just that collaborative part where we're working on a project and we're all kind of on the same page, like when you're playing music in a band, right? You're like somehow clicking with other people and like, wow, okay, this is cool. Let's riff on that.
Yeah.
That is like, to me, what I do it for. But it's at a similar level, sometimes just having some time, being alone, and writing something down, doing a calculation, and just thinking through that process. That's also, those things.
Those two things, being alone and being in a
group. Being alone and being together.
Those are the things you like most.
Yeah. I don't know. Does that make sense?
It does, because both of those, there are two completely different modes of doing work. And like, I'm sure like even people that do homework, like know about those kind of two modes of doing homework, right? Is one is just you're by yourself and seeing if you can work this out just with your own process, your own thought process. But then there's a separate mode of doing homework, very commonly seen in the some of the undergraduate hallways and rooms that they occupy, where they're like, it's the date before, what are we do? How are we doing this problem? What are we working? Are we getting? So what do you think is asking us for this problem?
Which is funny, because as a student, I was never that kind of person.
I didn't really do that much either as a student. But I did see it looked kind of fun. But I usually, I preferred to be doing my own, just to make sure that I really
needed to think through it myself.
Yeah. But now, of course, the problems now that we do are, are not homework problems. So we do, that collaborative aspect is much more powerful, because, you can't expect to be able to do it all, right?
Yeah. We all get ideas from talking to each other, ideas on what to pursue, but also just how to solve little technical things, and it accelerates things.
So and we can get into this a little bit later when we talk about actually, the stuff you're working on. But for example, like when you're at Space Telescope and there's some kind of group meeting or something, or there's an observation or something, how does that work? Is everybody's just kind of jumping in, and what kind of a problem would you be talking about?
Yeah, okay. You mean like for
just
like
trying to describe the process? What does it mean for an astrophysicist to solve a problem? Like, what does that process look like to somebody who's never been in that world?
Yeah.
So like,
I feel like so what I'm mainly thinking of are small research collaborations where it's me and one or two or three other people talking in a room at a chalkboard.
Right.
And it can be pretty nonlinear, honestly.
Right. But question I'm asking is we'll get into the science later, but give like an example of a type of problem that you would be doing that with? Like, and you know, just to give an example of flavor of that, what that is like.
Okay, so might be, so maybe here's an example. Might be sitting at my own desk, mm-hmm. trying to calculate something I've already decided to calculate. Mm-hmm. And by calculate, I mean, like, what does this look like? I have this thing doing this. What will it look like with a telescope? Okay, very general. Mm-hmm. And then in doing that, I'll think, or maybe somebody across the hall is doing the same thing, and they'll think, okay, but what if actually this part we're not including mm-hmm. happens?
We'll, so it'll be some calculation. Yeah. Maybe it'll be something, a black hole is eating some gas or something like that.
Yeah.
And you'll be doing some there's a bunch of physics that goes into it. You'll be doing some calculation, and then you'll say, like, oh, but there's some aspect of the physics I might be leaving out, or yeah. I am definitely leaving out, but yeah. it might matter.
Or it might matter in a different scenario I'm not looking at now. So maybe then I'll go across the hall to... I'm thinking back my old collaborator, Johan Samsing, mm-hmm. and I'd say, Johan, have you done this? Or has anyone done this? And if not, would it work this way? And we'd talk at the board and say, well, it should be of order this effect, so maybe this will show up here, maybe it won't. And either calculated some of it there, or talk about how we might do that. I mean, maybe mm-hmm. that's kind of a dry version of it, but...
No, but that's a kind of a yeah. basic idea. Is like you don't have all the answers. You haven't studied. Yeah. I mean, you know a lot of physics, but there's going to be some people that really know a lot more about specific parts of the problem.
Yeah.
And so you'd be like, oh, maybe this is worth thinking about. You know.
Yeah. Are there other scenarios where you just meet with a bunch of people maybe that mm-hmm. are around and say, this is a bigger question we want to solve. Mm-hmm. How do we get there? What is it we should start thinking
about?
Right,
what are the steps to get it to, like, okay, we broadly want to understand how, like, how
gas... I want to know how black holes merge in gas.
Very vague question, generally.
So what are the pieces we don't understand, and what do we have, tools do we have to start, you know, cutting away at this?
But anyway, all those sorts of conversations are fun and bring you joy as part of the job, being able to just sit around and talk about physics.
Yeah, because they often lead to things you hadn't thought of before.
Right.
And that's exciting for many reasons.
Yeah. Okay, good. So that's what you love about being an astrophysicist. What is anything you don't like about your job?
Well, a job's a job, Paul.
No, is there anything you don't like?
that's a different what do I not like about my job? I mean,
nothing.
It's not nothing. I just don't know how to
You're never unhappy.
Well, I mean, sometimes there are deadlines that you have to work a lot for.
Right.
To tell you the truth, I'm not I don't really like public speaking.
Okay.
But it's a big part of the job.
Yeah.
And I can get excited about it because I'm talking about things I'm excited about.
Right.
But I'm never excited about giving a talk, honestly.
You're never looking forward to that.
Yeah.
It's kind of
But I don't, I've learned to like it over time.
Yeah.
But I think the hardest part, but this is true in most every job, is that sometimes you just have huge deadlines and have to work all weekend for a few weekends. And,
right.
And sometimes that's just a lot of work.
Yeah. But nothing like... horrified, like nothing you
no,
really
hate
happy. About it.
I'm pretty happy
overall, pretty happy about it. And so now that you're an astrophysicist, what would you know if you were looking back? Was there anything like particularly challenging? Like, what was your most challenging part of getting to where you are right now as an astronomer at the Space Telescope?
Probably the middle of grad school,
just like halfway through grad school.
Yeah, I remember there was one point in grad school where for Christmas, my cousin got me a book on tree identification, especially the non-deciduous trees.
Tree identification.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we're into that in Pennsylvania, Paul.
Okay. All right.
I think it was a time in my PhD where, it gets difficult sometimes. You have papers you want to finish and mm-hmm. things are slow and... you're learning this process.
Yes.
And I was like, I think I was thinking to myself, you know what? I'm going to go to the Morningside Park and identify all these evergreen trees.
Uh-huh.
And then I was thinking of, well, maybe I'll just do this for a living instead. It didn't make any
sense.
You're
like, this just seems just such a more relaxed pace.
Peaceful and relaxed, and there's all this pressure right now.
Why am I feeling all this pressure to figure out how these black holes work?
Yeah.
Why can't I just go look at trees and figure out which ones are which?
Yeah, right.
It just seems so much more relaxed and peaceful.
But a funny thing happened like a week or maybe a few days later. There is this kind of discovery that came out,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, the phone number PG1302.
PG1302, I know that one.
Yeah, supermassive black hole binary candidate. And that came out a couple days later, and I met with my advisor, Zoltan, and he was like, we've got to write like 3 papers on this in like a week. And I was like, wow, okay, let's do it. I'm up for the challenge. And I worked really hard with a few other people at that time.
Yeah.
And we put out these papers and it was really satisfying. And they were, you know, reasonably well received. And I think that really changed my mind. I was
like,
okay, I do want to do this.
This is really fun.
Yeah.
This thing came out and I got to say something about it and I got to make an impact.
But there are certainly some lull years in the middle of grad school where I'm like, this is hard.
Right. I'm doing all this work and I don't really know what the point is. And but that's cool that you got to have that experience, that moment, like, especially in your moment of like, well, maybe I should just chill out and look at trees.
Right. It's funny and, weird that I told you that, but I just remember the trees and then PG1302.
Well, that's good. So PG1302 brings us in the direction of actually doing science. We can talk about PG1302 if we want. But let me start by asking about what you do more generally. So when you meet, this is the question I always ask, this is specifically the way I ask it. When you meet a new grad student or fellow scientist and they ask you what you work on, what do you tell them?
Gas, gravity, and gravitational waves.
Gas, gravity, and gravitation. Okay.
It depends which kind of physicist I'm talking to.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Gas, gravity, and gravitational waves. So,
or I might say gravitational wave astrophysics.
Gravitational wave astrophysics. So let's start by saying, what is a gravitational wave?
Okay.
We've mentioned it before on the podcast, but it doesn't hurt to say what a gravitational wave is.
Yeah. I mean, I like to think of, you know, conventional astronomy, or actually how we observe most things, is with light.
Mm-hmm.
So the messenger of the electromagnetic force.
Okay. So light, the way, you know, just like regular light and also other things like in part of the electromagnetic spectrum, radio, the x-rays, all of that still counts as light.
Yeah.
But the gravitational waves are something different.
Yeah. So then I think of gravitational waves as the messenger of the gravitational sector.
Okay.
So when you change, so I think the reason I say that is that you imagine let's just put it this way first though, that we said there's light.
Mm-hmm.
Light occurs when you change an electromagnetic field. I know that sounds a little technical, but you have some electromagnetic fields set up in space.
Mm-hmm.
It's sourced by a charge, maybe. But if I move that charge around, the field changes, and that mm-hmm. information has to be conveyed to me somehow. And it's conveyed through light, right? It's conveyed through electromagnetic waves.
So this is a deeper question I was expecting to do.
Yeah, I could have said ripples in space-time.
Which is, but, right. No, that's fine. I might as well say it in the way you want to describe it, because, you know, we've already had people say it's ripples in space-time. But it's okay. So light, there's this whole electromagnetic force, and everywhere in the universe there's an electromagnetic field somewhere, well, you know, some places stronger than others, and whatever the electromagnetic field is at one location depends on where all the charges are and what they're doing. And how do they communicate when they move from one place to another? How do I know that those charges have moved from one place to another? Is because they create a wave in the electromagnetic field. And that that's how information, and that propagates from the charge to me. And that that wave is this thing we call light.
Yeah. Moves at the speed of light.
It moves at the speed of light.
Yeah.
That's why we call it the speed
right.
of light.
Exactly.
But it's a wave in the electromagnetic field that it is sort of whatever electromagnetic field is present throughout the universe.
Yeah. So now the analog for gravity.
Okay.
There are gravitational fields.
Right.
The sun is setting up some gravitational field at which the Earth is listening to. It's orbiting around the sun.
Mm-hmm.
But if I were to change that gravitational field by blowing up the sun or something like that,
Okay. But if you do something, if you move the sun somehow, that information has to be communicated to Earth in order to change the gravitational field that the Earth feels.
Yeah. And that's done through a gravitational wave.
Right.
And they're both waves. They're both communicating changes in this information of where charges or masses are moving. But they just have different characteristics. We see light in these different wavelengths. Gravitational waves, what they do, they are these now ripples in space-time that propagate this change in the gravitational field. And they cause these oscillating changes in kind of distances.
Okay, so good. So I like that you did a much more physics-y explanation. But anytime you have masses wiggling around somewhere in space, moving back and forth and somewhere in space, it causes it, because it needs to communicate that information to the rest of the universe.
Yeah,
it causes this. It's done so in this with these waves that are these ripples in the fabric of space-time.
Yeah.
So basically, the actual distances, if space was like a bunch of graph paper, the distance represented by like the margins on the graph paper is changing as the wave propagates by.
Yeah.
And so then it's just a little bit, just wiggling just a little bit that stretches and compresses space, space itself. And so then these waves pass to us and we can detect them. That's the idea?
Yeah, that's the idea. We can detect them only for the last 10 years.
But right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's gravitational waves. Oh, that was just one part of what you said. You said gas... what did you say? Gas, gravity...
Yeah, and gravitational
waves. Gravitational waves.
So there's some overlap between gravity and gravitational waves.
Right. Okay, so why gas?
All right, so to ask why the other two, why gas and gravity... I think there's one more thing to say about gravitational waves, and that's what we think creates them in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, to create gravitational waves that are, you know, strong enough to detect, you have to have some really extreme gravitational objects to do that, and those are black holes. So the main thing that creates gravitational waves are essentially two black holes getting together and merging with each other.
Okay.
So that's a really big change in the gravitational field that happens, that we can detect the ripples of.
Okay, so when two black holes merge, you get strong changes in gravitational field, which will result in these ripples in space-time that are these gravitational waves, and those are strong enough that we can detect them on Earth.
Yeah, exactly. So I bring them up because it's been kind of a mystery for a long time. Well, a question of how do you bring two black holes together in the first place to cause them to merge and generate gravitational waves. This used to be more like, will we ever see gravitational waves? But now that we've seen them, it's more of a question of, well, how does this happen so that we do see them?
How did they get together in the first place?
Yeah.
Okay, and so that somehow has something to do with gas.
And it can have something to do with gas.
It can have something to do with gas.
Yeah. I'll give one example.
Okay.
So LIGO is one of these, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory has detected gravitational waves from merging what are called stellar mass black holes. Mm-hmm. So they might be tens of each of the black holes in this merger have a mass that is like 10 times the mass of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So these are built from stars, big stars that die and turn into black holes.
Right.
And so here's a conundrum. You might say, well, that seems pretty easy then. We know that stars are in binaries. Lots of them are in binaries, like half of them, maybe more if you count the big ones. So why don't they just, stars are born in a binary. When stars get old, they turn into black holes and they merge. Problem done. But if you look at the size scales in this problem, the two stars have to puff up into big red giants before they turn into black holes.
Okay.
And so you might say that the radius of a black giant, a red giant, the radius of a red giant is about how far apart those black holes could be.
Okay.
When they're left to their own devices to come together and merge.
Okay.
Because otherwise, the two stars would have expanded and just swallowed each other, and you would never have a black hole merger.
And they would have swallowed each other before they had the chance to be two black holes in a binary and then spiraling
exactly.
and merging. Like,
yeah. So you can say, okay, so they can't really start any closer than that red giant radius.
Okay. So just to restate that, when stars reach near the end of their lives, maybe our listeners know this. It's my parents, so I'll have to ask them. But the star will get bigger. They puff up. Like our sun is expected at some point, billions of years from now, it'll get really, really big, and so big actually, it should engulf the Earth, just because the nuclear processes going on in the core of the sun will have changed, and it'll cause it to get much bigger and puffier. And so generally stars, we see them do this, and so we know how big they get. And so then that means that we can say things about what that, you know, if we want to make two black holes, if you want to figure out what processes make two black holes in a binary, one part of that process is going to be like one of them is a black hole. The other one is still evolving and is getting much puffier. And if that puffiness engulfs, large enough that it overtakes the black hole companion, then the whole thing will just get eaten up basically by the black hole.
Yeah.
And so therefore that means that you don't start, you can't, there's a, that sets a max minimum distance that they can be apart when the second one turns into a black hole. And then you have a black hole binary. So that's a minimal separation of a black hole binary.
Yeah. So we've used some knowledge about stars to say this is this minimal separation. But the next part is to ask, given that minimal separation and what we know about gravitational waves, gravitational waves carry away energy just like photons do. And so as these two black holes are orbiting each other, they're emitting gravitational waves, which are carrying away energy, which is causing the orbit to shrink.
Yes.
And you can calculate how long would it take those two black holes to shrink and merge into each other,
right,
given this minimal separation.
Right.
And it turns out that it is much longer than the age of the universe at that minimal separation.
So any black hole binary you can imagine, taking that at face value, should never merge in the age of the universe.
Exactly.
But yet we see them merging all the time now with using LIGO.
Yeah.
So, okay, so that's a question. So apparently the answer to this is gas?
That's one answer.
Okay.
Another answer is gravity.
Okay, another answer is gravity.
By gravity. So there's our ways that people have thought about to solve this problem.
Okay.
One way is that, well, they're not formed in these stellar binaries that then evolve into two black holes. Actually, you just form single black holes.
Uh-huh.
But those single black holes live in a dense environment, a cluster of stars, the most common being what's called a globular cluster, which is one of the most dense stellar environments we know of.
Okay.
So you form these single black holes that didn't have to deal with this separation problem.
Right.
But they encounter each other later in life and capture each other into a binary. So they come by each other, whip by each other, and when they do that, they emit, for example, a burst of gravitational waves and become bound to each other. There's a few ways that you could get them to capture each other.
Okay.
But when they do that, they capture each other.
And they can be much closer then.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that break, you can be much closer than that minimal separation you would have guessed from evolving these systems.
Yeah, so that's the gravity way of doing it.
That's the gravity way of getting them to be close to each other enough that they can merge in the age of the universe.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And then maybe I won't go into detail now, but there are other ways. One, for example, is that, well, that whole stellar evolution thing that we just talked about of puffing up into a red giant doesn't happen the same way when you have two stars close to each other. Single star evolution might be different, or is sometimes different than binary star evolution.
Okay, so what we think stars do when they're alone, or versus what they do when they're in a binary, especially when their companion is a black hole, might be different from what we think.
Yeah.
And so that could potentially change our predictions for what this minimal separation should be.
Yeah, exactly. And so that involves hydrodynamics, gas.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right. So then maybe what I'll ask, because I was going to ask you what, you know, day-to-day research kind of looked like. I asked you a little bit about that, mm-hmm. but maybe I should ask you in relation to this PG-1302, or but tell me more about PG, I know about PG-1302, but I'm going to pretend like I don't. Tell me about this PG-1302
yeah,
object sure. that you spoke of earlier.
Sure. So what we just talked about were these stellar mass black holes, tens of solar masses.
Mm-hmm.
But there is another, I guess you can call it, type of black hole, at least in astrophysics speak,
mm-hmm.
called a supermassive black hole.
Right.
And these are not tens of solar masses, they're tens of millions or billions of solar masses.
Right. Supermassive.
Supermassive. And they live at the centers of galaxies.
Okay.
So we have lots of evidence that at least single supermassive black holes live at the centers of galaxies, including our own. The Event Horizon Telescope has taken a picture of gas flowing around that black hole and a nearby black hole in M87
right.
galaxy.
So we've actually just taken, on the very nearby ones, we can actually image material right around that
yeah,
black
which
hole.
Which is amazing.
And get
yeah.
direct evidence that there is a black hole at the center of our own galaxy. And what was the other one? M87, right?
M87, yeah.
And so, okay, so those are supermassive black holes, millions to billions of times the mass of the sun. So
yeah.
just huge, absolutely huge.
Yeah, enormous.
And so those black, what were we going to say about those black holes? Something relating to PG-1302.
Right. So they exist,
black
holes. But we also observe another thing in the universe, and that is that galaxies merge.
Mm-hmm.
They come to, we have pictures, beautiful pictures with Hubble Space Telescope and other telescopes of galaxies merging. And we even have pictures of the black holes accreting gas and those merging galaxies coming close to each other. But the point is that when this happens, you expect that two supermassive black holes will come together in this new galaxy that's merged and form a binary. And just like the binaries, the smaller black hole binaries we were talking about, these should come together and merge and emit a really powerful gravitational radiation. But so there's a lot.
There's
I'm
a lot. No,
here.
That's fine.
Yeah.
So when each galaxy has a supermassive black hole at its core, and then throughout the evolution of the universe, different galaxies will merge with each other. So you have two galaxies merge, and then the black holes at their centers will presumably form into a binary.
Yeah.
And then you can have a supermassive black hole binary at the core of the merged galaxy.
And this is where that phone number PG-1302 comes in.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out, just like I was saying, we weren't sure how the small ones merge. We're even less sure how the big ones merge for very similar reasons that you can't get them close enough
right.
so that they merge in time. And so people, including myself, have been looking for these systems when they're in that stage where they should be getting close
mm-hmm.
and getting ready to in spiral and merge. And PG-1302 was a candidate system for this I've been working on studying for a decade.
Right. And so PG-1302, this is an old system that humans have been able to look at for at least a century, more than that. But it's this bright, what we call a quasar. It's a black supermassive. Well, we've known at least one supermassive black hole is there, and it's eating a lot of gas, and it's shooting out this bright radiation that's coming from the gas that's accreting onto it. And then, but what is special about PG-1302 that made your advisor Zoltan Hyman go up to you and be like, "We have to write three papers on this"?
Right, exactly. So something that had been predicted. Now back to gas.
Mm-hmm.
You just said that, you know, this thing is super bright, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the brightest quasars in the sky. And it is so bright, the idea is because a gas is falling onto the supermassive black hole. And it turns out that is one of the most efficient ways to turn matter into light in the universe. So it's super bright.
Mm-hmm.
But then the idea is if you have these two supermassive black holes down there orbiting around each other, they'll also be really bright, but they'll churn up that gas in a way that you'll see the brightness go up and down in a periodic motion that is related to that, you know, periodic gravitational two-body problem just orbiting around and around.
So when we look at PG-1302 and we look at it and we observe it for many years, we can see how bright it is, getting dimmer and brighter and dimmer and brighter in a periodic fashion. You can actually see it's periodic. And the thought is that that up and down has to do with the orbital motion of the binary going around and around each other. And we're seeing, and we're witnessing something about that binary orbital motion. Well, assuming that it is a binary.
Yeah, right.
But it's not confirmed that we know that it's a binary. But the theory behind it would be that it's instead of a single black hole, there's a binary at the center. And that motion of the binary, that orbital motion of the binary, one way or another, is causing the signal to go up and down.
Yeah, exactly. And this had been predicted. And so when some people at Caltech, JPL, put out this result that they're looking at this quasar and they see that, that's when Zoltan got excited, I got excited, and we worked on some papers to try and interpret that in terms of the binary scenario.
Oh, okay, so how do you write a paper, or what was your contribution, to that result?
Yeah, so a few things. One is to try and put this in perspective about what we know about all the other quasars.
Okay.
And how many of them we expect to have binaries. So one thing you can do is say, okay, if this is a binary, then, and we saw this binary by looking at X number of quasars, and we think that, you know, 0.1% of quasars should have these binaries, does this make sense in that scenario? So starting to do the statistics of what we know about the number of quasars and expect the number of binaries and putting it together.
Right. So, okay, so you can, if you have some, in other words, relating the fact that we saw this after looking at X number of quasars, relating that to the idea of like what fraction of supermassive black holes in the universe are in binaries, and trying to do some kind of statistical calculation about that.
Yeah, which is also difficult because we don't know how many.
We have we really kind of have no idea, but we're learning that.
Yeah.
Okay, and then, so that's one part
of it. That's one part. Another part is actually interpreting that oscillation that we saw.
Right.
This light going up and down.
So I vaguely said that it somehow has to do with the orbital motion, but then what? But actually trying to make some statement about how does that turn into brightness going up and down?
Yeah. So at the time we had been doing these calculations, these numerical calculations of gas accreting on to these binaries, and computing exactly that. How does the light go up and down from this accretion process? So we're comparing to those models. And we also came up with a new model, which is called the Doppler boost model.
Yes.
That was really fun when we ended up writing a Nature paper on that, because this Doppler boost model said, I could explain it very quickly.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
Sure.
Is essentially, imagine you have the Doppler effect is something we all know from when, you know, an ambulance comes by and we hear the pitch increase as it's coming towards us and decrease as it's going away.
Right.
The same thing happens with light, but in this case, it'll look bluer when it comes towards you, and it'll actually look brighter too, and then redder and dimmer as this source of light moves away from you.
Okay. So it's the same idea for light as it is for sound, that like you described the car driving by, or ambulance with its siren, or a car with its horn, if it's honking, then it'll be higher pitched when it's going towards you, and it'll be lower pitched when it's going away from you. And, you know, we kind of start to instinctively know that, even if we didn't know why it was. But, and then the similar, like you said, a similar thing happens for light. It's a higher frequency and therefore bluer when it's coming towards you, and it's a lower frequency and therefore redder if it's going away from you. And so but it's also not just bluer, it's brighter.
Yes. Yeah.
And so you're saying that the idea would be that that's caused by the motion of the binary, in the sense that when you're seeing one of the black holes coming towards you or moving away from you, it makes it brighter or dimmer.
Yeah, right. So we could calculate, because we knew how fast the orbit was, or we could estimate how fast the orbit was, we could estimate how much brighter and how much dimmer.
Right.
And we did that, and it matched observations really well. And then we were able to predict that we'd seen all this in optical wavelengths, but we could predict that it would actually be an even larger amplitude of oscillation in ultraviolet wavelengths, and we could predict exactly how much.
Uh-huh.
And we did that, and then we had a colleague at Columbia, David Szymanowicz, who has done a lot of UV observations, and he helped us get the look at the archival, the past UV observations, and they matched that prediction. So,
wow.
So we wrote this paper on that, and that was really exciting.
That is exciting. Yeah. So you got to have this result. This PG-1302 comes out. Zoltan, like, we need to write a bunch of papers on it, and then you got to make not only sort of explain after the fact what could have caused it, but then make a prediction that you could then go look at archival data and see that it
seemed to follow.
That it seemed to follow, yeah. to match with your predictions. And so that's PG-1302.
Yeah.
So the model seems to work really well, that would suggest that it's in a binary.
But we have lots of data since, mm-hmm. and some of it still is oscillating around, but not exactly the same period.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's still something that we're thinking about now, if
right.
it still fits the model or if it's broken, and we're trying to understand that.
That's the other great thing is you can keep looking at it and see if it can, if it still holds up to your predictions.
Yeah, so just to give you the context of how long this takes, one oscillation takes 5 years. So I said it was a decade ago, but that means we get two more boops.
two more oscillations in that decade.
Yeah.
And so that's more time to sort of understand, like to see if it keeps oscillating the way you think it will, if it does something different. And then if so, then maybe you have to either modify your ideas, or maybe there's maybe something else is causing the oscillation.
Yeah, something else interesting about a single black hole.
Right.
Creating gas.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. So, let me ask that. So that's PG-1302, and you've done lots of other different types of projects, but that kind of thing, black holes, gas, gravity, and gravitational waves, but that's a good example of a nice, impactful result. So maybe we're getting close to time, so maybe I'll ask you my big question I like to ask everybody.
Oh, all right.
Which is, in your opinion, why should we care about astrophysics?
So I think it's probably the main, I mean, not astrophysics itself, mm-hmm. but kind of just, and maybe think of how I would put this another way. I think that if we had, you know, we didn't have to worry about all the normal things we usually worry about, money and war and eating and you know, we had all these things, then what would we do? We'd think about astrophysics, right. or some other fundamental physics or art,
right.
or the things that that humans seem to tend to do, to uh-huh. want to understand the things around them, to make beautiful things.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're doing it because that's what we're doing all these other things for. I mean,
I put the question in that way because it does sound like an accusatory thing. Like, why should we care about astrophysics? You know, and then some people might fill in the blanks and be like, when there's all these other things to worry about, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have to make sure that, you know, everyone's clothed and fed and make sure that, but what you're saying is, you know, in a, you know, when your society gets to a point where, where it's working to do all of these, to be a great society and do amazing things, what is it going to do with all of the success that it has? Like, is it just going to sit there and just be a society, or do
it's
we
the ultimate specialization?
Do we
and so when not just astrophysics,
right? But of course, it's not just about astrophysics.
Yeah. I think if something happens that we stop doing astrophysics, it means there's other much more dire survival related things that we have to deal with.
Right.
And so a good mark of a society is that we are doing those things. I think that's
right. Yeah, it's that's right. If you feel like we can't do those things, that means that something that there's
yeah
we're not in a good place, right?
Yeah, right. I think I've heard some versions of the kind of statement too. When you know the senator asks, "Why are we not using this money for the military, and instead we're giving it to you people to think about PG-1302?" Answer, right?
Right, right.
The answer is because we have a military, so we can do these things.
Right. Oh, that's good. I like that. That's why the military is there, so that we can look at PG-1302.
Yeah.
Maybe. It protects us that we have just a second so we can look at PG-1302 and understand something about how the universe works.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I'm not even going to say that the practical matters that...
No, that's fine. Everybody has a different answer to that. And I think it's good, you know, some people jump straight to like, oh, well, we invented cell phones or whatever.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yes.
But like, I actually prefer the non-practical answers because that's the actual reason we do it. what is the next thing you're excited about in astrophysics?
Well, one thing I'm super excited about is seeing gravitational waves from these really big supermassive black hole binaries, because we haven't seen gravitational waves from them. We actually really haven't seen any evidence, like definitive evidence of them. And there's a few things coming up that will give us that, I think.
Okay.
So gravitational wave detectors that will see the really, really big mergers now and in the 2030s.
Yes.
And also some big electromagnetic surveys of the sky that might give us many, many more PG-1302 type objects.
Oh, okay. So you're thinking of, with the new gravitational wave detectors, you're thinking of pulsar timing arrays, we won't get into what they are, but which is, we're detecting, at the moment, there is at least a claim that they have detected a signal that could, the most plausible explanation is it's coming from sort of the general hum of gravitational waves from all of the supermassive black holes binaries around us.
Yeah, that's quite a statement. But that's so, what we think. Yeah.
And so that's what pulsar timing seems to have detected so far. And then that data will only get better as we look at pulsars for longer. And then there's also this LISA. Mm-hmm. That's, I assume, what you meant when you said 2030s.
Yeah, that's what I meant, right?
That's the Space Gravitational Wave Observatory that will hopefully launch in 2030s. Mm-hmm. And then that is calibrated to measure these supermassive black hole binary.
Yeah, and it might find things that we weren't expecting. There's a lot of space there for the unknown.
That's right. You know, that's always the thing you're really excited about is when you look at something in a new way, that you always see something that you didn't expect.
Yeah.
Very cool. And then you also mentioned the new things for in electromagnetics, like you were probably referring to like LSST and
the Vera Rubin Observatory, Large Survey of Space and Time, LSST, and then also the new Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope.
Yeah. And so those are going to probe very deeply and be able to see lots and lots of signals from many quasars, and hopefully a bunch of them will be in binaries, and we'll be able to there'll be, like you said, more PG-1302s for us to understand. That would be great.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I think that's about all the time we have. So thank you so much to Dr. D'Orazio for joining us. I had a lot of fun talking science with you, and I hope you'll join me again sometime.
Thanks, Paul.
Well, I'm so glad I finally had the opportunity to host Dan D'Orazio. We had a great time talking about black holes. So thank you again to Dr. D'Orazio, and thank you to our listeners. We will see you next time. For this one last month, the Astrophysics Podcast is still supported in part by the National Science Foundation under grant number AAG-2206-299. After that, I'll just be doing this just for fun, but always ad-free. Music on the Astrophysics Podcast was written and recorded by Britton Ashford from her album Trotter. All songs are used with permission from the artist and producer. Look up Britton Ashford if you enjoyed the music. This podcast is produced in beautiful Lafayette, Indiana by me, Paul Duffel, professor of physics and astronomy at Purdue University.